Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello there, this is Eat Sleep Work Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. It's a podcast about making work better. Now, today's episode is a standalone. It's not really about making work better. It's just a fascinating conversation with an interesting guy. I chatted to Dave Trott, who's sort of a legend of the creative business in advertising. I chatted to him last week. The audio is not the best quality ever. Forgive me on that. We tried to record it off the desk and couldn't. So we used a tape player that was situated near the stage. You're going to get a decent quality audio, but not amazing. And it's not a talk about work culture. So on those grounds, I give you a pass if you don't want to connect with it. However, you're missing an entertaining and stimulating chat with a very famous legend of creativity. Dave Trott's a creative director, copywriter, author. He's published a series of best-selling books, most recent of which is called Creative Blindness. Along the way, a few years ago, he was awarded the DNAD President's Award for Lifetime Achievement in Advertising. Just a man of held in the highest regard by his peers. Along the way, he's created advertising that really is sort of timeless and renowned. Some of the most famous campaigns ever for brands like Cadbury's Flake, Cadbury's Cream Eggs, Toshiba's Hello Tosh Got a Toshiba that people of a certain age will remember. Dozens and dozens of internationally acclaimed adverts. Latterly, the last few years, it's been on Twitter and with his books that has earned him a new audience. His books like Creative Mischief, Predatory Thinking, 1 + 1 = 3, and his new book, Creative Blindness, have won new audiences and new acclaim. And they're just full of incredible stories, some of which you're going to hear today. So caveat, it's not a discussion about work culture. In fact, to some extent, Dave espouses a long hours and sort of burnout culture that I'm not always a big fan of, but it's always fascinating to hear someone who's obsessive about creativity and about doing new and original things and hearing firsthand from him. And if you stick around to the end, you'll hear the funniest story you'll hear on a podcast this year. Here's a conversation at the IAB Leadership Summit last week with Dave Trott.
Morning, Dave. So a little bit while you're away, you're a day into a conference here, and the leadership conference, there's been no mention of creativity yet. I wonder if you could sort of give us your perspective on what you think the state of modern creativity is.
Well, what you got is it's like perfume. You spray it on to cover up a bad smell. Everybody says they're creative. Nobody is. You start your checklist, you tick it on your website, you say we're a creative, whatever it is, you're nowhere near creative. So a guy the other day described himself as a creative strategist. What that means is he's a planner, and he's ashamed to call himself a planner, so he calls himself a strategist, but he doesn't want you to think he's just a strategist, so he calls himself a creative strategist. Creative is real dead simple. Steve Jobs, one of the most creative people there ever was, and Steve Jobs said, why would you want to join the Navy when you could be a pirate?
And you're saying Jobs, not Jobs?
Yeah. When I first heard of him, he used to pronounce it Jobs. Okay. Now people call it Jobs. But I don't know. I suppose in Scotland you would still better call it Jobs.
Because I saw you quoted Bill Byrne back. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah.
And he said that creativity is the last unfair advantage we're allowed to
We're legally allowed to take over the competition.
So to some extent, you know, if we're sitting there and... What would creativity look like then that we're not doing now?
Well, that's
do
what
you mean specifically ad copy creative?
And I know you'll know this. You've been a victim of this. Is what real creativity is about is... Well, what Job said is, why would you want to join a Navy when you could be a pirate? If you don't enjoy getting into trouble, if you don't want to break the rules, if you just want to be a good boy and progress gradually and do what you're allowed to do, that's not creativity. It might well make you a lot of money, you might well be successful. You'd be Bill Gates instead of Steve Jobs. But you'd still be a good guy, but you won't... Don't confuse that with creativity. Don't call it creativity. Creativity is breaking the rules. I was talking to a lot of... Indian people, a couple thousand Indian people about it. My wife's Chinese and I talk to her about it a lot. She's an art director. Asians struggle with what we think of creativity because it's really difficult for them to be disobedient.
So that's an education thing. That's all...
Well, it's a cultural thing. It's filial piety. It's from Confucius on down. You want to get good marks from your teachers. You want your parents to love you. You want to be proud of you, proud of everything you do. Whereas in America or in England, it's fine to get into trouble, to be disobedient, to be naughty, that's kind of creative. Now, because we shun any kind of, we're now scared stiff. Immediately you get in trouble for anything now, you pull it and issue an apology. You don't revel in the trouble you get in, the controversy, and enjoy it, and realise that creates more noise, more free media. Every time someone talks about it, it's a free OTS, it's media you haven't paid for. I was taught in New York, and the whole point was, you weren't any good. One of my heroes, Ed McCabe, he always said, I'm constantly in trouble, and I think that's proof of my worth. And it's exactly the opposite now. Now we're all supposed to, now that this generation is like old people. What they want to do is not get in trouble. Well, that's something to aspire to, isn't it? Let's all be bank managers. What was the point? Now you're going to call yourself creative. Where's the creativity in that? I can get a computer to do that. I can get a computer to not get in trouble. To not break the rules.
And you were talking just before when we were in here, you were talking about Jeff Ma from Alibaba.
Yeah.
And what you just said there seemed to channel what Jeff Ma was saying. So do you want to explain what Jeff Ma was saying?
Jack Ma, I don't know if you know.
Jack Ma.
I assume you know Alibaba. Jack Ma, one of the richest guys in the world, but one of the biggest things in the world. This is more your area than mine, Jack Ma. And I was reading about it. He's just left there, and he's moved into education because he says the big problem at the moment is what we are teaching our children is what computers will always be better at. And AI is always going to beat us at those things, and then we are teaching our children that. And Jonathan Haidt, I think it was, behavioural economics guy, said, and Harvard study I was reading, they said, what you have to know about AI is the hard things are easy, but the easy things are hard. So they can learn, when things like complicated games of chess, they can learn that and they'll always beat us at that, because they'll always be faster. And as long as we study that, we will lose. So what we need to be studying is the things that can never do, which is the things we learn before we're 5 years old, when we're programming our minds to be intuitive, to be creative, and that's what Jack Ma has now gone to study and hopefully to change education towards. And if you look at Ken, if you know the Ken Robinson talk on TED, that's much more about that kind of thing.
There's an interesting thing there, isn't there, that what we seem to be setting our brains up to do more of, being busy, being focused, trying to channel concentration, seems actually, when you look into the science of how our brains work, also to over-scheduling ourselves, seems to be at the expense of thinking of ideas. I saw a brilliant thing. I was looking at neuroscience, and it was sort of categorising the three systems in the brain, and the main system in the brain is called the executive attention network, sort of focusing on stuff. Second system in the brain is the salience network, and it's sort of running background prediction to what goes on in here. And then the third system in the brain is called the default mode, or the default network. And it's sort of where you daydream. You know, a lot of people say, someone said to me, I get my best ideas when I'm walking the dog. Yeah. Someone said, I get my best ideas on the loo.
Yeah.
And my favourite example of this is the guy who wrote the West Wing TV show, or he wrote the Social Network, film, a guy called Aaron Sorkin, he said he was having his best ideas in the shower. And so he had a shower installed in the corner of his office. He says he has 8 to 10 showers a day.
Yeah, great.
I told that to a cosmetics firm, and they said, we hope he's got a good moisturising routine. Which is interesting, isn't it? Back to the Jack Ma thing, we've over-engineered work, we've over-scheduled ourselves, thinking that that's going to be... going to produce insight, and actually maybe we're making mistakes in the way we're wiring everything.
Yeah, I've got no problem with work. My motto all my agencies has always been energy beats talent, and what I've always tended to hire is hungry young northerners. They've always worked great in my creative department.
Because the energy beat talent thing is an interesting one. I was reading you talking about the culture at your agencies,
yeah.
And you said anyone was allowed to work on any piece of work.
Yeah.
So effectively, once you've done your work, you're allowed to start working on other people's pieces. Yeah. Explain, because that sounds a bit sort of cutthroat, dog eat dog. Explain how that looked and how that worked.
Cutthroat, dog eat dog.
Right, hello. Yeah.
What you do is, I'm not making rules for the world. I'm not making rules for everybody else. I'm looking for a gap that I can occupy, I can own. You're always looking for a niche. You know, I'm not a politician. I'm not making rules for everybody else. It's like if you take Ferguson, he's not making rules for the rest of football. He's looking how he can exploit the weaknesses in other teams in order to win. So the misunderstanding is everybody else gets up and pontificates about what everybody else ought to do. This isn't rules for everybody else. What I'll do is look at what everybody else is doing and do something different, which is creative. You don't make rules for everybody else. Once everybody else is doing it, it's no good to me. Then what will happen is the best will win. Well, that's no good to me. The best winning is not creative. What's creative is, how do I beat the best? How do I beat the fastest, the richest, the strongest? I've got to find a creative way to beat those guys. So part of that was all other ad agencies were hiring the best creatives and the most expensive creatives. And I thought, well, for the cost of those most expensive creatives, one of those, I can get half a dozen youngsters. And so for the cost of 4 or 5 of those, I can get 20 youngsters. And if they're northerners and they come down to London to make it, which these kids had, you've got no choice. You've got no distractions. You either make it here or you go back home. So they're perfect for me. And all they want is, every time I give them a brief, it's like giving them a present, because it's a chance to make it. And because I was trained in New York, I understand exactly that attitude. This isn't like England, where you've got to be embarrassed about working hard. And work is a terrible imposition on us. This is work, and you love work. That's why you're doing it. If you don't love what you're doing, do something else. But if you do love it, do it. You know, this is my work and my hobby.
So how did you facilitate them working on each other's stuff?
Right, so what I would do, what I always used to do when I was a junior, I used to hate the fact that I would only get given the junior briefs, trade ads and things like that, while the seniors would get given all the TV. So I used to wait till the seniors had gone over the pub, and I used to go around their offices and steal their briefs, work on them overnight, and then sell them to the account men before they got in the morning. Didn't make me a lot of friends, but I wasn't there to make friends. I reckon, you know, I cut 8 years off my career. I did 10 years career in 2 years. And I thought, well, let's formalise that for these youngsters. So I'd have a load of wiped clean boards on the wall, and everybody would have their own board, and on it, written in red, would be what you're working on, but it hasn't been bought yet. And written on it in black would be what's been bought and it's in production. So everybody could walk along and see. The deal was, as a youngster, once you've done your trade ads, you can walk along and take any other work on there that hasn't been done yet. So if the seniors haven't done their TV yet, well, you can have a go at it if you want. And the only thing stopping you is whether or not you want to stay here at night or come in at the weekends or whatever it is and do it. If you don't want to do it, then don't grumble that your career's going slowly. And up to the speed that you want to go, you want to proceed at. And I got that idea out of Dale Carnegie book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Great book, much traduced because of the name. It was written in about 1930. And the name, it was the first of those how-to books. And since then, a load of other books have been written. And consequently, that book's not appreciated as much as it should.
Still top 10 bestseller, even now, this week.
It had a great story in there. I mean, the more broadly you learn from everywhere else, you can apply those lessons. There's a great story in there when a guy called a Scots guy, forget his name, bought Bethlehem Steel. And Bethlehem Steel was going bust in America. Bethlehem Steel was going bust. because it was doing one smelting per shift, one in the morning, one in the evening. And this Scots guy bought it, and he walked around on the day shift, and he said, and because he was there, they worked hard to impress him. So he said to the foreman, "How many smeltings did you do today?" And they said, "Two." And he said, "Okay," he grabbed a big lump of chalk, and he wrote a massive great two on the ground where the night shift will walk in. And night shift came in, and they said, "What's this?" And the day shift said, "We did two smeltings," and the new owner wrote that on the floor. And the night shift thought, "Bastards, trying to make us look bad, right?" So the night shift did three smeltings, and they kicked that two off the ground and wrote a massive great three on the ground. And the day shift came in and went, "Bastards, what are you doing?" And he was getting them between four and five smeltings every shift without firing a single person, without giving anybody a raise, because people were now competing like it was sports. People love to compete. That's why when you look at the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, they got built under budget and under schedule because they put an American team on the job. The Petronas Towers. And instead of putting one team to build both, they put two separate teams, one on each. And the American teams are each desperate to beat each other because they like competition. And work is fun. Work is a game. And work doesn't have to be the the European way we remember the feudal times of slave master and a whip. Work can be fun. This is a game and I'm going
to
win.
So there was something that you said along the way there, which I think is a good entry point to a bit more discussion, which you said that, if everyone else is doing one thing and you're doing something else, that's your advantage. And I think we can often find ourselves thinking all the good ideas have been taken, all the innovation has been done. But yet now, if we look, I find it fascinating. If we look at any company, most companies now are run on people having 20 hours a week of meetings, people using email all the time. I met someone yesterday who said, "We don't use email in our company." And I thought, wow, the first time I've heard something that feels different, that someone's deliberately wiring their company up in a different way.
I think things like that are great. All I would say is I don't think blanket, here's 10 ways to be creative and stop using email, have beanbags, let's hot desk, let's do blah, 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 blah. That's just stuff. That's not creative. Anything you can make 10 rules of that you give to anybody, then that's not creative. The creative is, what are the other people doing? And I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something different.
So I really liked, in the book that we gave everyone, I really liked the fact that quite often you said that a creative idea was born out of a couple of problems coming together. So there was a couple of examples. The prisoners and the dogs, I thought, was a really interesting example of two problems that sort of solved each other. Do you want to talk through that?
Yeah, always. If you're really smart, you've got a problem, you put it together with another problem, and usually that makes a plus. So they had the problem of all these recidivist prisoners in the States, and they couldn't get to them, hardcore violent criminals. They didn't know how to get them to change their ways. And they also had all these dogs that were about to be put down because people wouldn't adopt them. And what they did is they said to the prisoners, each of the prisoners, they give them a dog for 10 weeks and say, if you can change this dog's behaviour, it will get adopted. And they would give the prisoner the dog in their cell to look after for 10 weeks. And the prisoner would transfer changing that dog's behaviour to save that dog's life and teaching that dog why it needed to behave, why it needed to stop growling, why it needed to act nicely, why it needed to sit down, and he'd clean it and he'd wash it and he'd look after it and he'd get its teeth and its nails done. And usually, after 10 weeks, the dog was a changed animal and the dog will get adopted. And amazingly, the prisoner was a changed person too, because suddenly the prisoner had seen why obeying the rules actually worked. In saving the dog's life, the prisoner had seen how obeying the rules actually paid dividends and how it could work. And you put two minuses together and you get a plus.
So is the secret of creativity then us spending more time trying to find those problems? If the creativity comes from really getting to the heart of a problem and then letting your mind wander of trying to think of the most expansive solution to that, is it about defining the problems first?
Oh, hell yeah. The problem is way more important than the solution. My art school was a Bauhaus art school in New York. And Bauhaus, everybody's heard of it, and everybody knows the line, form follows function. And they parrot it out, but they don't think of it. Form follows function. So function comes first. If you get the function wrong, well, how most people approach it is with an answer, with a form. But form follows function. They never define the function. So what you end up with is, you go around most art galleries, and most of that isn't very creative. That's just style. Edward de Bono says, there are lots of people calling themselves creative who are mere stylists. What a style is what you see in art galleries. It's not creative. There's no real thinking there. There's nothing unusual or different. You see beautiful chairs, absolutely lovely, beautiful chairs, but they're really uncomfortable to sit on. Well, use your loaf, it's not a fucking chair. That's function follows form. You've got this beautiful object. If you can't sit on it, it's not a chair. The first job is get a chair. Now, when you've done that, we'd like to make it beautiful, yes. But if you can't sit on it, it's not a chair. Einstein said, if I had an hour to save the world, the world was about to end and I had an hour to save it, I'd spend 50 minutes on the problem and 10 minutes on the solution. Because if I got the problem right, the solution would be easy. But if I didn't get the problem right, there would be no solution. By breaking down the solution, the problem, you will come to a different solution that gets upstream of where you were. The example, silly old example we always use is two explorers going through the jungle, and they hear a tiger roar, and they hear the tiger running towards them, and one explorer gets down and starts putting on a pair of running shoes, and the other explorer says, you're crazy, you'll never outrun a tiger. And he says, I don't need to outrun the tiger, I just need to outrun you. You won't solve a problem at the level you create it. You need to get above the level you created it and solve a different problem, and then this problem disappears.
I wonder if that's sort of connected to what the Jack Ma thing as well, that, yeah. You know, that if you're focused on solutions, then you get immediately into, here's our solution. Yeah. And the Jack Ma thing seems to be, let's try and teach people. Because that's exactly what the Ken Robinson talk is, isn't it? Ken Robinson talk says that if you look at divergent thinking, so I think they give paper clips to, yeah. they ask people to come up with inventive uses of paper clips. And it might be a fishing hook, it might be holding paper, it might be sort of stack them up into a tower. Yeah. And you're invited to do as many. And the kids of the age of 6 or 7 produce more examples of divergent thinking than adults. And so, what Ken Robinson says is that you're effectively teaching creativity out of kids. And Jack Ma seems to be saying the same. And what you seem to be saying there is that actually that freshness of thinking, of trying to identify a problem rather than jumping straight to the solution.
Yeah, so what Bill Birnbach, who's one of the greatest advertising person ever, he said, principles endure, formulas don't. If we learn principles, that's what we should be studying. Don't learn formulas. When you learn formulas, you cannot possibly be creative. That's for machines. Like they used to say for IBM, machines should work, people should think. So principles, if you study principles, so you can't teach formulas. Saying to everybody we're not having any email more than mail is a formula. Saying we're having beanbags and we're having open plan offices is a formula. That's not a principle of creativity. You can't study that. Principle is we're going to do something new, something you haven't seen before. Well, then obviously I can't show you that, can I? There can't be a formula for that. So what I used to do at my agencies is make sure people are exposed to tons and tons of creativity. So I'd take them to the cinema, I'd bring in loads of books and make sure everybody wore them. I'd take them to talks, I'd get in speakers like Edward de Bono. Every Friday afternoon, we'd have a creativity session where each week someone would be nominated to bring in the most creative thing they could think of and talk about it. And they'd have to nominate a different person. Now, maybe that worked, maybe it didn't, and then we'd find another thing to get. But the constant focus on different ways of opening up creativity, not closing it down to a formula, but opening it up to new questions all the time and arguing about it and getting the conversation going. So that all week, the guy who's got to do the talk on Friday will be talking about the water cooler or the coffee machine to people saying, what am I going to do on Friday about this creativity thing? You got any ideas? And other people are having to think about it or what they're going to do for the creativity thing on Friday. So the discussion in the company becomes to be more about what is creativity. And then in the argument on Friday, everybody asks when we meet up, people are saying, well, that's not very creative. I don't see why any other guy has to defend why he is creative. And we've got a conversation going about what creativity is. And you've got the whole question in the office about what creativity is, rather than, I want you all to wear red ties on Friday because that will make us creative. You know?
More of Dave after the break.
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now back to my discussion with Dave.
I was really interested when I was going through all your stuff that you see that, you know, if people are struggling with creativity, you often see it as a reductive process rather than an additive one, right? So sort of, you say in this book, you talk about the mosquito bomber and how it became sort of best in its field by them, by having a reductive process of thinking rather than, do you want to tell that story?
Well, in World War II, I love to look from all over. I like to look at football, I like to look at business. Military is a really good place to look because obviously that's a very heightened, stressful situation where you need to get creative. And Churchill had said, we don't have as much as, well, you know, in the years, Churchill said, we don't have as much as the other side. So we need corkscrew thinkers. We don't need straight line thinkers. And so part of that would be, the RAF and the American Air Force had big four-engine bombers. And these four-engine bombers each had crews of 11 or 12 or 13 men to defend themselves from German fighters. And you'd have more and more guns on these bombers. They'd load more and more and more guns and more armour on these bombers, which made them slower and slower and slower and slower. And they were getting shot down and guys were dying and everything like that. And Geoffrey de Havilland said, I think I'm going to look at this the other way. He stripped all the guns. He only put two engines on the bomber to make it lighter. And because he couldn't find any metal, he made the bomber out of wood. And he got Parker Knoll, the furniture manufacturers, to make the bombers out of wood. It was called the Mosquito. And it was absolutely light. And it only had two engines, two Spitfire engines, one on each wing. Not a gun on the plane, and it was faster than any fighter, and it could carry as much as a bomber, but the fighters couldn't catch it. And so it didn't get shot down. And the bomber crews, and it only had a crew or two, and the bomber crews loved it because they had much higher survival rate in this unarmed wooden two-seater than they did on this really heavily armed and gunned four engines bombers. And so they built Mosquitoes, and it was one of the best, most successful planes of all. By reduction and reduction and reduction and reduction and reduction. And that's what a brief and thinking is. David Ogilvy said, strategy is sacrifice. When you're putting a brief together, you don't load more and more and more and more and more stuff into it. You reduce it and you reduce it and you reduce it. If you're talking to ordinary people, they haven't got time for it. The ordinary person gets 2,000 advertising messages a day. You haven't got time to Mickey Mouse around with all the details. You better be really simple, and it better be really evocative, and it better be really different, it better be really powerful. So you better reduce what you're saying down and down and down and down and down and down until you've got the absolute grain. Like they make an oyster, gets made from one grain of sand, which gets wrapped around, and then the mother of pearl gets wrapped around that, you get an oyster. That's how it works. You reduce it down and down and down and down to one grain of sand, then you wrap the pearl around it. But the reduction is crucial for the strategy department.
Does it mean that creativity is far more solitary than committee-based? Because the way that you've just described there, I was thinking of all the times that a good idea has been encumbered by someone says, yeah, but can you just add this? Can you just add this on? Can you just do this? And I wonder if, in its essence, we sort of need to trust people by giving more faith to creative people rather than by allowing committees to intervene.
Well, you know, the one thing that hit me about creative is it ain't who says it, it's who spots it. Everyone thinks to be creative you have to be the guy that wrote it, and what I've learned is no, absolutely the opposite. You have to be the guy who spots it. Sometimes it would come out.
I don't understand.
Okay. Sometimes it would come out, and I'd be sitting with John Webster, who's the best there ever was, and I'd be talking, and we'd be talking about what we were, and John would say, hey, back up there, what you said there, that was brilliant. And I'd say, what did I say? And John would say, that thing you said about so and so and so and so. And I'd go down as the writer, and I'd be an award-winning writer, and I didn't even feel what I said. John had spotted it. And the guy who's listening is capable of spotting it. The guy who says it often isn't. But everybody has to have the ownership of it by thinking, if I didn't say it, then I'm not the owner of this creativity. And actually, the real creativity comes from spotting it. So whatever situation you need to be in, and it changes every time. I used to sit on the tube, on the Circle Line when it went round and round, and just look at the people opposite me and think, how do I talk her into this? Or I used to go to the supermarket and watch the people buying it and think, how do I talk her? I used to stand in the pub and watch the people. Or just anything, or go and get drunk, or go to the cinema, whatever I need to do to shake my brain out of a rut. And it will be different every time, because it's creative. It'll be different. Sometimes idea might pop up in a committee, idea might pop up on my own. I find showers are really good. You get a lot of good ideas in the shower. I've got one place at home I like to sit. My wife, being Chinese, believes in feng shui. So I've got one place there I like to sit that's really good. You'll find all those things. What you have to do is keep an open mind.
But let's add those two things up, because you started off by saying you're really unhappy with the state of modern creativity,
yeah,
or that you weren't filled with optimism, and yet, you know, we're more evolved, we've developed. So why are these two things not connected? Why is, you know, knowing all of the sum total of the knowledge that you said here, why are people not being as creative and inventive now? Are we doing what you said the schooling system of other countries does, schooling people into obedience? And if so, how do you advise the people in this room to sort of cultivate disobedience?
Well, disobedience and going back to basics. The problem is there are too many answers, so you haven't got time for any questions. The problem is all you've got is a menu of, what you know, I don't even know all the different technological terms, because I stay away from them, because it just gets in the way. But it's like someone, you know, you don't go and sit down and think, what do I eat now? Someone comes over to you with the menu and says, what would you like to choose? And that's how every problem is now, is your menu of all your different media choices. Quick, hurry up, I've got four other things happening. Choose one, quick, there you go, that's out the door. And with programmatic and automatic and all the other things, you just, I stay away from it, because there isn't time to think with those guys. They're technicians. They call themselves creative, but they're just technicians. And you aren't going to get any. There isn't even a possibility. They don't even want a different answer, because a different answer is scary. They want an answer from the allowed list. And you know better than me what the allowed list is. And you haven't got time to think of anything different. So, and the allowed list is so huge, you haven't got time to go off-piste.
But would you advise people then at the outset, before they sit down to start thinking of execution, that they spend more time, you know, back to your 90% of the time or 50 minutes in the hour, thinking of the problem? Is that where you think you're falling down?
I can't tell you a formula. That's why I love that Steve Jobs quote. You decide for yourself if you're in the Navy or you're a pirate. And if you're in the Navy and you want to do it properly and you want to get good marks and you want to pay your mortgage and you want to get on well at work and earn money and just do that, then that's fine. Just don't call yourself creative. If you want to be, if you are creative, you won't need me to tell you. You're gonna get in trouble. You're gonna get fired sometimes. You're gonna get expelled from school. People aren't necessarily gonna like what you do, and sometimes you're gonna hit that ball out of the park. Sometimes it's gonna be amazing, and people are gonna say, "Why'd you do that? You're so creative. Nobody else could see that. Nobody else could see. You're gonna see things other people couldn't see." And Bill Birnbach said, "If you stand for something, you'll find some people for you and some people against you. If you stand for nothing, you'll find nobody for you and nobody against you." So, if you don't want anybody to dislike you, don't stand for anything. Don't just be like everybody else. Have it like a regular old office job, like you could have worked in a bank. Don't call yourself creative. That will just confuse you and make you unhappy. Just carry on doing your job like an algorithm and just enjoy the rest of your life. Wait till it's time to retire and you can start living.
For the digital audience you've got here, there's a pot of it. For the digital audience you've got here, I thought Quentin Crisp's take on the difference between manners and etiquette was instructive.
Yeah, yeah.
Just largely because it's sort of, you know, a lot of people here might find themselves using jargon or find themselves in sort of quite esoteric language. And I thought his take on the difference between, I guess, a Brit who went to the New York and he said there was a difference between etiquette and language. Yeah. I thought that was relevant to
well, there is that. There's another thing Americans said, which is, it wasn't American, it was Einstein. It's always credited to Einstein. He said, if you can't explain it to an 11-year-old, you haven't really understood it. Now, I think most of the people I deal with couldn't explain what they do to an 11-year-old. They couldn't explain it in really technical language, because that's all they do. But that takes you further and further away from any thinking. Now you're just reacting like an algorithm. Quentin Crisp, I used to draw him. I didn't know it was him at the time, but when I was about 16 in East Ham, I used to go to life class at East Ham Tech on a Saturday morning, and they had this naked model that was really grumpy, with a big poop blonde bouffant, purple bouffant, and really grumpy. And I was only 16 at the time, I didn't know, and he had a great big tummy and skinny legs and breasts and a posing pouch. But years later, I found out it was Quentin Crisp. He did male modelling because it was the easiest way to get money without work. And he went to New York and he said he'd learned the difference between Brits and Americans was the difference between politeness and manners. And Brits had manners, but Americans had politeness. Or the other way around. Americans had manners and Brits had politeness. But either way, what it was, and it's the same with language, is Brits use manners to exclude people, and Americans use it to include people. So Brits, when you go to their house, good manners or politeness is supposed to be, you've got to know which fork to pick up, otherwise you feel like an outsider and everybody looks at you and you're embarrassed. It's exclusive. Whereas what Americans would do is take all the forks off the table except one and say, yeah, we don't need them, have the one you want. In fact, we don't even need a knife, just have a fork. Much more inclusive. And so Americans will be much more like that with language. They'll reduce it to monosyllables. So one of my favourite things in the war was how Churchill got the lease-lend program through Congress in the States. Roosevelt was trying to get the lease-lend program through, which was how America would give us weapons without actually joining in on our side. Still stay neutral, but give us weapons. And that, Americans didn't want to approve that at all. And this is a very complicated, big fat folder of paper to explain it. And all Roosevelt did is he stood up to Congress and he said, look, when your neighbour's house is on fire, you don't refuse to lend him your hose pipe. And that was, he'd reduced a quarter of an inch thick document to a sentence that nobody could argue with. And the lease lend program went through and we straight away got 50 destroyers and all the tanks we needed for North Africa. And well before America came into the war. Just by that line, when your neighbour's house is on fire, you don't refuse to lend him your hose pipe. That's reducing all of that complicated language to what Bill Birnbach calls simple, timeless human truths. things that we can all understand, monosyllables, language we all speak.
So the power of reduction again, it's power of sort of definitely, communication definitely. Is about saying less.
Definitely, definitely. We talk like human beings, yeah, yeah.
We're running out, almost running out of time. I just want to, because it's my favourite story ever, I just want to give you this copy of The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could tell us that story.
Well, I don't know why, it just seemed quite ordinary, but in the creative department, everybody's all creative. And the thing about creatives, real creatives, is they're all rebels and rejects. That's what creatives are, rebels and rejects. And so in a department, you've got to follow that. And we used to have, this going back to the 70s now, at BMP, we all used to read the same book at the time so we could talk about it. So in 1 week, we were all reading The Exorcist. And one of the guys, the head of TV, used to live in Brighton. And he used to commute in from Brighton every day. And he said to us, he said, that book is vile, it's foul, it's evil. He said, it's the most evil book in the world. He said, I couldn't even finish it. He said, it's so evil. He said, at the weekend, I went to the end of Brighton Pier and threw it as far as I could. He said, so I thought, well, that's... So I went down to the bookshop and I bought a copy of The Exorcist. I went in the bathroom and I ran it under the tap and I left it in his drawer.
I think,
he still doesn't know how to swim. It's 30 years ago, he still doesn't know how to swim.
I think the fascinating thing is that, from the perspective of starting and saying you're pessimistic about the state of modern things, actually you've given some really clear guidance. You know, if we want to be creative, we've got to be sort of troublemakers, we've got to be the pirates rather than the navy.
And you mustn't look for agreement. You've got to be the kind of person that it's okay for you. That was what was great for me about going to New York. It's a country found, America is a country founded by rebels and rejects. Mm-hmm. And it was great for me. When I was there from 19 to about 23 or 24, the formative period in my life. And what you learn is the thing that stops you is your own worrying about what other people think of you. And if you do that, you can't be creative because you can't be a pirate because you're too worried about being in the Navy and doing what people will allow you to do. You've got to enjoy getting into trouble. And we used to love that. It meant we'd get on the front page of the Sun. We did LWT. We did what you now call out of home, which being analogue, I still call posters. We did LWT and we did a poster a week, 70 posters, one a week. And we used to do them. And the job was, because it was one a week, to get it posted on a 48 sheets. Get it posted, if anyone in here knows what a 48 sheet is. Do it, big ones. We do it on a, get it printed over the weekend, get it up so for Monday morning everybody would see it. Everybody would be outraged, everybody would complain, it would be all over the papers. They'd force us to take it down by Wednesday. We'd drag our feet, probably get them all taken down by Thursday or Friday. And then we'd have the next weekend's one up again. We'd have all that free press coverage about it, all that controversy in the papers and everywhere about these posters being there. We'd get five times what we were paying for, the media we were paying for. Instead of which, what you do nowadays is pull it down, issue a huge apology and don't run any more posters. It's like, so it's not, you know, the whole atmosphere is the opposite of creative. The whole atmosphere is political correctness has killed creativity. Anyone who's dumb enough to go along with that, you go on YouTube and type in Stephen Fry and political correctness or John Cleese and political correctness and just hear how it's killing comedy, how it's killing everything, how fear of what you can and can't say is killing everything. And if you're the sort of person that still likes to get into trouble and still thinks that's fun, then that's creative, yeah.
And you're saying there's as much opportunity as ever before. Dave, we're out of time. People can follow you on Twitter. You're a very good follow on Twitter, it's worth saying, as well as your blogs. I'm thrilled that you joined us here today. Thank you so much.
Great.
Thank you, Dave.
Amazing. I love that story. That story alone was worth the ticket price. So, thank you. Thank you for listening. Some good episodes coming up over the next few weeks. The best way to stay connected to the podcast is to either subscribe on Apple Podcasts and leave a review while you're there, or to subscribe to the New Work Now mailing, and that's going out every 2 weeks on a Sunday. Always look forward to hearing from you. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm Bruce Daisley. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.